This interview with Richard Capriola is an important one for parents as we discuss the dangers of drugs, alcohol and vaping on the developing brain of a young person. Richard is a retired addictions counsellor who has worked in treatment centres for children and adults in America. He has written a handbook for parents called The Addicted Child, which acts as a parenting manual, highlighting the signs to look out for as their child approaches adolescence. The book acts as a preventative measure and as an educational tool for parents, which is very much needed. We talked about the latest statistics in regards to trends we need to be aware of and how to keep our children safe from the dangers of substance misuse. It's an unmissable episode and one I think you'll enjoy. So here's Richard. Thank you. So hi, Richard. It's lovely to have you on my podcast. And of course, we have spoken before. I looked and it was back in December 2021, and it just seems like such a long time. Exactly. It seems like such a long time ago, because of course we were just emerging from the COVID lockdowns and the world looked like a completely different place to where it was when we left it in 2019. And then, of course, we were starting to see then the effects of the lockdown that, you know, on our children, and not too sure what those implications were. You and I spoke about the drugs and alcohol usage and addictions that you had counted and done lots of studies on that. So it'll be wonderful to sort of like now, 3 years on, what the latest research is now telling us about those COVID years and what that all means. But before we get into that, then I'd like you to introduce yourself and tell the audience, you know, who you are, what you do, and why you do what you do.
All right. Well, thank you, Sherry. It's a pleasure to be back with you again to talk about this important topic of adolescent substance abuse. My history includes working for over a decade at a mental health psychiatric hospital in Houston, Texas, which treats both adolescents and adults diagnosed with mental health and substance abuse disorders. I was an addictions counselor employed at Menninger Clinic on a number of their units, including the adolescent treatment unit, as well as an adult comprehensive assessment unit. And during that time, I had the pleasure of meeting with families whose children were struggling with the substance abuse. And I saw the pain that they were going through. Many times they were surprised to learn of the extent of their child's substance use. Very good parents. They missed the warning signs because nobody had told them what to look for. And unfortunately, it escalated into a crisis situation, which forced them to intervene and get the help that their children needed. And after I left Menninger Clinic, I retired after working there about a little over a decade. I wanted to write this resource that would help parents understand about adolescent substance abuse. Equip them with information that would help them, let them know what the warning signs are to look for, what tests they should get done if they think their child is using substance, and a brief explanation of how the drugs work in the teen brain and why the teen brain is different, say, than the adult brain, what treatment options are available, and resources. And the title of the book is The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse. It's available on Amazon as a Kindle or a paperback. Or people can go to the book's website, which is helptheaddictedchild.com. But my purpose in writing the book, which I kept to around 100 pages, is to help help parents and others feel more confident and less paranoid and less afraid about this topic.
Yeah. And that's really important, isn't it? Because it can be so overwhelming. You're dealing with so much information plus your own personal emotions as well involved in that, the shock that comes from all of that, and you haven't got a clue really where to start and how it's all going to end as well.
Yeah, and it catches many parents off guard because they weren't as prepared as they wanted to be. I think that knowledge is power, and the sooner we can see the warning signs and know what to do and intervene, it's like anything else. The sooner we can catch it, the sooner we can intervene and hopefully get treatment that that will benefit both the child and the family as well.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen sort of like an increase in awareness amongst parents about substance misuse now, 3 years on? Is there more of a heightened awareness? Are you hearing that maybe from, you know, emails that they send you or letters or?
I don't think that there is a tremendous increase in awareness. Unfortunately, I think this is a topic that many parents want to avoid. They're under the perception that this is something that can't happen to their child. So it's a scary subject, and like most scary subjects, people tend to stay away from them. But in this situation, I think that knowledge is power, and the more parents know about this, hopefully the less afraid they feel about it and the more confident they feel that if they have to deal with this issue, they hope they don't, but if they have to deal with it, they're prepared with the information to be able to deal with it in an effective and timely manner.
Mm-hmm. How open have you found schools to be supportive for parents that are going through this? Is there any support?
I think there is, I think from teachers, from counselors, psychologists, social workers, I think there is a lot of empathy for parents that are struggling with this. I think they try to give these parents as much support as they can. And that's an important point, Sherry, because so many times we focus on the child. You know, the child who's got the substance abuse. And we forget that the parent is going through a crisis too, and the parent needs support. So, yes, I think that the school community, the teachers, the professionals, they can be a tremendous support to parents, as well as community organizations too, and support groups for those parents, which is very important for parents as they go through this with their child.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because I think as a parent, once you've been confronted by that, I guess your first stop would be then to go and see your doctor and get a diagnosis. And as we said, you know, that's then for the child. But then the parent then comes away perhaps not feeling supported themselves and knowing, you know, where to reach out within the community to get that help and support for them. Because in order to really help their child, they need to be in a good place too.
They do. And unfortunately, many parents, because of the stigma that surrounds substance abuse and addiction, many parents may feel, you know, ashamed, or they may feel, well, how are people looking at me now? How are people judging my family and me? And sometimes that tends to keep people from reaching out and getting the support and the help that they need. But that support is crucial for a parent that's going through this. Because if you're struggling with a child who is using substances and maybe in treatment, this is going to be a journey that's going to take some time. So you deserve to have support and help just as much as the child deserves to have the support and the help that they need too. But unfortunately, in too many cases, I think the parent is neglected.
Yeah, it's so true. And what does the help and support look like for the young person when it's discovered, and what are the most sort of like frequent ways that it presents itself and then gets flagged to where?
Well, I think what I advise parents to do is pay attention to the changes that you see in your child, because those can be sort of red flags that there might be something going on. Maybe it's not substances, maybe it's something else. But if you pay attention to the changes that you see and you're curious about those changes, it might open some opportunities for you to discover some things about your child that may or may not need assessment and treatment. But if you feel that your child is involved in drugs or alcohol, and you want to reach out and get some assessments done, you can certainly start with the school community, the school counselors, the school psychologists and social workers, many of whom can do some preliminary assessments for you, or refer you to professionals in the community that can do those assessments and tests. Because as a parent, you want to have some professional advice as to what's going on, and you want to either rule in or rule out what the problem is. You know, maybe it is substance abuse. Maybe it's another psychological issue that your child is struggling with. Maybe it's anxiety or depression or some other issue. But as a parent, you want to rely on the professionals to give you those assessments and that advice. And if there is a diagnosis as a result of the assessments, then you want to know what the treatment plan is. What are the options? What are the next steps that I need to take? And you need to rely on the professionals to give you that guidance.
Mm-hmm. So what we're talking about is more preventative steps, isn't it? I mean, it's the better place to be, isn't it? It's before an issue has manifested itself into a crisis, for parents to educate themselves better and prepare themselves better for those preteen years, because that's where the most likelihood of, you know, mental health issues and the drug and alcohol misuse are likely to present themselves, isn't it?
That's right. And as a parent, as you said, you want to have as much knowledge, you want to feel as prepared as you can. You want to know what the warning signs are, what to look for. You want to know, you know, what to do if you are concerned and who to turn to, because the more knowledge that you have, the more confident I hope a person will feel that if they have to deal with this issue, whether it's a mental health issue that your child is struggling with or a substance abuse issue that your child is dealing with, you feel as a parent that you're prepared to deal with it when and if, you know, the issue arises.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that when that child gets then diagnosed and then they're admitted into a treatment center for however long that might be, they're also working then with the parents, aren't they, putting that plan together, and I'm guessing, you know, however long that duration is and then what it needs to look like at home.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You know, as a child goes through a treatment program, especially if they're in a residential treatment program, there will be a family therapy component to that program. And that's an opportunity for parents and the child to work with a professional to deal with the many issues that surround the family, not just those that perhaps involve the child, but the entire family structure, the family dynamics, to work through those issues that maybe have not been discussed in the past, and then ultimately to prepare a discharge plan for what is life going to look like in the family when the child returns home. So, you know, the residential program very often will have a family therapy component to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so important, isn't it, to have that all-round kind of like support then, because you can't have one without the other. You can't treat the child and the parents are just as clueless, let's say, as when the child went in.
Yes, because many times the parent needs help as well. The parent needs support. And the entire issue of, well, what is life going to be like when the child returns home? You know, that's an issue that needs to be addressed and discussed before the child leaves treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking particularly, you know, creating that safe environment mm-hmm. as well, because, you know, as a parent, I don't think you could help but keep thinking that, but okay, so they've come home clean, but how do I keep them off those drugs, the alcohol, the, you know, whatever substances it is that they're using?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, all of that needs to be discussed before the child leaves treatment, as well as what the home environment's going to look like, what are going to be the rules, what are going to be, how are they going to be enforced, what is the role of each family member, because this is an ongoing process. It doesn't end when the child leaves treatment. It continues. And in many times, families change too as a result of the treatment process. And as a result of the family therapy, you know, there are changes that occur within the family. Hopefully these are healthy changes. And not only the child, but the family comes out of treatment feeling stronger, feeling more prepared, you know, to move forward with their family life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very important point that you make there. So when we look at the trends, you know, what is trending? What has changed since 2020, 2021?
Well, the big effect of the pandemic was that it produced a significant decline in adolescent substance abuse. Children were confined to home. They were not involved with school. They were not involved in social activities. So it's not surprising that during that pandemic year, adolescent substance abuse declined significantly. Now, we've had some data in the last few years about what has happened after the pandemic. And what we've noticed generally is that there has been a slight increase in adolescent substance abuse since the pandemic, but it has not gotten back to where it was before the pandemic, with the exception of alcohol use. Alcohol use is back pretty close to what it was before the pandemic. But these other substances, marijuana, you know, vaping of marijuana, vaping of nicotine. There have been some increases since the pandemic, but again, most of these drugs and the use of these drugs is not back to where they were before the pandemic. Now, whether they'll eventually get to that level is yet to be known. And that's not to say that some of these statistics are not still alarming. You know, for example, we're seeing that 15% of eighth graders are drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that roughly, you know, almost half, 46% of high school seniors are drinking alcohol. So those are still pretty high levels. And when it comes to marijuana, about 30% of high school seniors are smoking marijuana, and about 30% are vaping marijuana. So, you know, the percentages are not as high as they were perhaps before the pandemic, but they're still pretty alarming figures in terms of the percentage of kids that are either drinking alcohol or smoking marijuana. It's still a problem that parents need to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good to put it in that perspective, because the initial reaction might be when you said that the numbers are significantly down since COVID, it makes it look like, wow, that's actually really good. And it hasn't sort of like, you know, increased back to the previous pre-pandemic levels. But then when you say like 30% or 15% of eighth graders, you know, drinking alcohol, then, you know, no one could find that acceptable. Yeah. But what do you think the reasons are for the fact that we still haven't seen those numbers increase to the levels that they were before.
Well, I think part of it is the perception among teenagers that these substances are not harmful. When we ask them how harmful they think alcohol is or marijuana is, you know, 80% of them tell us that they don't think these substances are very harmful at all. So there's a perception among teenagers that these drugs are not very dangerous. And the other issue is that the drugs are widely available. When we ask teenagers, how easy is it for you to get alcohol? How easy is it for you to get marijuana? They tell us it's no big deal. We're able to get it if we want it. So you have the wide availability of these drugs and kids who don't perceive that they're very dangerous. So that is one of the problems that we're dealing with in terms of trying to reduce the percentages of kids who are using substances like alcohol or marijuana, which are the two primary substances that teenagers have been using for years. You know, prior to the pandemic, we noticed that vaping of marijuana and vaping of nicotine was escalating at alarming rates. And those rates still are very high. Kids are vaping nicotine and vaping marijuana at alarming rates.
Yeah. That just seems to be a trend, doesn't it, amongst young people. You know, I don't really hear about young people smoking cigarettes.
Yeah.
You know, they vape. And I think it's marketed a lot also anyway to young people because of, you know, the attractive packaging, the different scents and all of that. So it's already sort of like packaged and marketed in a way that would come across as it's not that harmful. It's just a bit of fun that, you know, kids kind of like do. So, you know, I think that, you know, a lot of the blame could be in the manufacturers of those substances.
Well, you're absolutely right that smoking cigarettes is at an all-time low.
Mm.
But kids have switched to vaping nicotine. And the issue with that is that when you are vaping nicotine, you're getting pure nicotine. Whereas when you're smoking cigarettes, you're getting nicotine and carcinogens and tobacco and a whole lot of other things. But when you're vaping nicotine, you're getting pure nicotine, which means you're getting higher concentrations of nicotine. So although these kids now are vaping nicotine, they're getting much higher doses of nicotine into their brain and into their lungs. But it has become a very convenient way in which to smoke nicotine.
To have fun. And what are the effects then of nicotine on a young developing brain?
Well, that's the important thing that I think parents need to appreciate is the adolescent brain is different than the adult brain because our brains become fully developed around age 24, 25. So when you take an adolescent brain, which is in the process of maturing and developing, it becomes very vulnerable to any type of substance, illicit substance that's introduced into the brain and runs a risk of potentially doing some damage that might be very subtle at the early stages. You may not notice these changes, but over the longer term can make some changes in that child's ability to think, to process information, and to do the skills that they're going to need as an adult. But the brain of an adolescent is very vulnerable because it's in the critical stages of developing and maturing and trying to form those connections that child will need later as they move into adulthood. And anytime you put a substance, an illicit substance, into the system, it's going to go to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
and runs the risk of making some changes in the brain and doing some harm to that brain.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, is worrying because, you know, as you said, vaping nicotine is far more intense than smoking nicotine is. So if it's already having a negative impact on a developing brain, then, you know, we're talking about perhaps, threefold the negative impact?
Well, it's you're getting higher concentrations of nicotine, which means more nicotine is going to the brain, mm-hmm. which then means that it has the potential to be stronger on the brain. And also because you're vaping it, it's getting into your lungs as well. And again, the lungs are being developed as the child grows and gets older as well. So both the brain and the lungs, respiratory issues may occur if that child continues to vape and then perhaps continues on into adulthood vaping, and like cigarette smoking, may end up vaping for years and maybe decades.
And we don't know the true effects of vaping beyond that, though, do we yet?
No, we don't, because I don't think we've got like 15, 20, 25 years of history yet on it. Although I would say that a lot of the results are similar to what we know happens when people are smoking for 10, 15, or 20 years, especially on the lungs and the respiratory system.
Mm-hmm. And what's the average age then of the young person's vaping? Is it 12? Is it older? Is it younger?
I think we tend to see it more in the high school population. You know, these surveys that are done, you know, are done of kids who are in 8th grade, 10th grade, and 12th grade. So as early as 8th grade, we're seeing some vaping. You know, 11% in 8th grade are vaping. So I would say that starting in probably middle school, early high school is when we start to notice kids beginning to vape nicotine or marijuana. I don't think you see that too much earlier than, say, 7th or 8th grade.
Mm. I wonder if parents on the whole see vaping as a softer substance or choice than cigarettes, and perhaps wouldn't step in as much or vehemently as they would if it was cigarettes.
I don't know. I would hope that that would not be the case, because regardless of whether they're smoking cigarettes or vaping, the effects, the potential effects on the system are the same. And I would be concerned as a parent that if a child is vaping, they're getting such higher concentrations of nicotine. And nicotine is a very addictive substance. Mm-hmm. It will get people addicted fairly quickly. So if you're vaping pure nicotine, it's going to become addictive very quickly.
Mm-hmm. And how about alcohol? What kind of, you know, when you said sort of like 8th graders, what kind of alcohol are they then consuming?
Well,
easily access it.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it is beer. Okay. Mm-hmm. We know that, you know, if we look at beer, you know, there's a high percentage of adolescents who drink beer. Some of it is in the form of shots, where they will take beer and maybe mix it with liquor. Mm-hmm. Some of it is in these drinks that they get. But I really think that probably beer is the number one priority. It has not beer drinking has not returned to the pre-pandemic levels. And it's declined a little bit. From 1991 to 2023, the lifetime use in 12th grade went from 82 to 42%. And in 10th grade, it went from 74 to 27%. So it's declining a bit. But still, you take roughly a quarter of, say, kids who are drinking beer, that's still a high percentage.
Mm. Yeah, it is indeed. And what else are you seeing then in those results there with young people?
Well, there's still a lot of alcoholic beverages with caffeine that kids are using. So they're mixing the alcohol with caffeine, not high percentages, but some. There's also flavored alcoholic beverages that are being used. So there's different ways in which kids are getting their alcohol, whether it's in a flavored beverage or whether it's a beer or whatever. It comes in different forms now, which means it's more available to kids. I still think that the primary substances that teenagers are attracted to continue to be what they have been for years and years: alcohol, marijuana, and now vaping.
Yeah.
There's not much use of the hardcore drugs like cocaine and opiates. Those tend to be far less than 5%, and in some cases only 1 or 2%. I think one thing that parents need to be aware of, though, is this epidemic that we're seeing in fentanyl.
Yeah.
Fentanyl is a very, very powerful opiate. The thing that I think parents need to be aware of is not that their child is going to go out and look for fentanyl. That's very unlikely. The real danger is that fentanyl can sometimes be laced or mixed in with other drugs that are on the street. So you may be, a child may be taking a drug and not aware that it has been laced with fentanyl, mm-hmm. and then have some very unfortunate outcomes. So the parents need to be aware, and kids need to be aware too, that yeah. these drugs that they're buying off the street are not as pure as maybe they think they might be. And there could be the possibility that they're laced with a drug that could be very harmful to them, like fentanyl.
Mm-hmm. Which is scary, and I can imagine that parents, that would be their a huge concern of theirs, because you just hear about it all over the place. And of course, we've seen all the videos of people in the big cities or high on fentanyl and in a zombie like state. And as a parent, it would be worrying if you've got young children that could likely come into contact with drugs.
Yeah, and again, it would be very inadvertent. It would be a child who picks up a drug or is offered a drug and it's laced with fentanyl, and they know nothing about it, and mm-hmm. you don't know how much fentanyl is in the drug. And that's why it's important to impress upon teenagers that if they're buying drugs off the street, they really don't know what they're getting. They may think it's one thing when in fact it's another. And that's the scary danger of kids buying these drugs from sources that they don't know.
Mm-hmm. So what would your advice then be for parents listening to this and wondering, When would be a good time? What would be the best age then to start a conversation? And what should the conversation look like?
Well, I would say that in elementary school, for example, mm-hmm. I would talk to the child about the brain. I would try to help that child understand, as in elementary school, how important the brain is, what the brain does, what the very areas of the brain are, because kids are curious. They want to know about things. So I would stress in elementary school teaching them about the brain, so that when they leave elementary school, they have a fairly good understanding of how important the brain is and what it does and the need to protect it. Then as they move into middle school and high school, with that understanding of how important the brain is, then you can have conversations about what drugs do in the brain. So first you teach them about the brain mm. and the importance of protecting the brain. And then you teach them about how drugs work in the brain. And I think that approach, in my experience, has had success with teenagers, because they're curious and they want to learn. Giving them lectures about how bad drugs are, or how illegal drugs are, or how harmful drugs are, or how they may experience poor grades or drop out of school mm. or not get into college or not get a job, all of that doesn't mean anything to them because they don't believe it. But what they are interested in is how the brain works. So if you can help them understand what drugs do to the brain, then I think you have a chance of getting through to them. And that's why I included a brief chapter in my book about the brain, so the parents understand the importance of a brain. For example, in my book, there is a picture of a brain and the different parts of the brain and what they do. And then there's another picture that shows where marijuana attaches itself to in the brain. So you can see where marijuana is attaching itself to the brain. I think those images can be very powerful for a child, because once you teach them about the importance of the brain in elementary school, you open the door to having conversations later about what drugs can do in the brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such an amazing approach. And as a parent, I could imagine that you would be sitting there waiting to decide, should I go into a lecture, like you said? And it just falls on deaf ears, especially right. when they've entered, you know, those teenage years and they're just rebellious and they're not going to listen really to you. Or you know, what angle to kind of like, you know, take it from, sort of like, you know, like you said about grades, or you could end up killing yourself or something like that. And then we wonder why that's not having the impact that we wanted it to have then on that young person.
Well, they don't want to be lectured to. They don't want to be told what to do and what not to do, especially when they get into, you know, middle school and high school years. They want to be independent. So the lectures aren't going to work. If anything, they're going to alienate the child and perhaps make them, you know, angry. But a discussion that is geared more towards, you know, the neuroscience of it. From your perspective, not the child's perspective, you can just start with a conversation about how, you know, the brain works and your concerns about the brain. But the neuroscience approach is the one approach that I think stands the best chance of catching a child's curiosity, regardless of the age, mm-hmm. and allows them to have input into the discussion as well. They may argue with you about some of these concepts about the brain, and they may still think that the brain is not going to be formed, but at least you've got a discussion going about the brain and the importance of the brain that that may impact that child at some point. Maybe not right away, but maybe as they think about it, you know, down the road, it may have some impact. But that approach, I think, stands the best chance of actually reaching the child and helping them understand the importance of protecting the brain and what these drugs can do to the brain.
Yeah, no, I really love that approach. And I just think it's also, you know, when you said start in elementary school, you're sowing the seeds because, you know, like you just said, you don't always know the impact of what it is that you're saying, how much they're taking in of any of that. Right. But as you progress in those discussions, as you'd said, you know, by the time they reach middle school, for instance, and you're talking about that, then they've got that memory already behind them, haven't they? And then you're connecting what they knew before or thought they knew before about the brain, and then putting it together with, and then when you have alcohol, when you smoke marijuana, this is what then the brain looks like. I mean,
exactly.
Very, very powerful.
Exactly. You tie it together so that you're putting a neuroscience approach, which is an understanding of the brain and the importance of the brain and how it develops, with an introduction of how substances can affect the brain. And you're letting the child draw their own conclusions. Mm-hmm. It'll be fairly obvious, but it's not that you're lecturing them. You're just helping them understand what's going on so that they can better understand how things go. That's a lot better approach, in my opinion, than giving them a lecture about, you know, how dangerous drugs are and how illegal they are. Yeah. That's not likely to be very successful.
No, I mean, we don't respond well to being lectured at either. So why with our children?
Exactly.
It's like I said, a really good approach, because I think we can all, I mean, we would all fall into this bracket where you underestimate the powerful addictive qualities of drugs, of alcohol, of you know, anything that we suddenly become very reliant on, and suddenly we're hooked, perhaps without us even intending to be.
Yeah, it happens very quickly, unfortunately, and sometimes it's something that gets out of control and spins out of control and can have very devastating impacts, not just on a child, but the entire family structure as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then when we talk about sort of like, school-aged children, we're also talking about peer pressure as well, because, you know, trending, as you said, you know, marijuana has always been, hasn't it, something? Yeah. And then beer, very easy to access. Again, a bit like the vaping where it's manifested itself into the pop culture, when you were talking about the different flavors, well, that's also to make it more digestible, isn't it, for the younger yeah. people, because beer normally has quite a bitter, off-putting kind of like taste to it until you get yourself accustomed to it. If you add lovely flavors to it, it's even quicker then, isn't it, to start that habit.
And you know, all the flavoring that we see with the vaping too makes it more attractive to teenagers and adults. But definitely it is a marketing approach that gears upon, making a lot of options available. And the flavoring is just another way of marketing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the strongest message to take away from this is then to have an open conversation going with your child. And I guess also being aware of who is in their friendship group. You know, who are they hanging out with? Who are they spending most of their time with? And what are those kids up to?
And that's one of the warning signs that I point out to parents. You know, a child who now becomes very secretive of who their friends are, or becomes very secretive about where they have been and what they have been doing, that's a big warning sign. And parents need to be aware of what some of these warning signs are so they know what to look for. Some other examples are a child's grades are dropping, they're declining. Another example would be a child who used to participate in sports no longer shows an interest in doing so. Some of these changes sort of come and go fairly quickly. They're not too concerning, but if they linger on and you begin to see more and more of them, then I think as a parent, you want to get some professional assessments done so that you can either rule in or rule out whether there's a problem. And if there is, what's the best approach to dealing with it?
Mm-hmm. Of course, there's the other side where you're suspecting something. You've had all of these conversations and your child is refusing to have an assessment done.
Yeah.
What would your advice to parents be?
My advice to parents is get the assessment done whether the child wants them or not. I've never met a child, a teenager, who wanted to go in to be assessed. I've never met one who wanted to go into treatment. But the parents, you know, have the responsibility to do what they think is best for the child. And a child's going to tell you no. No, I don't want to go in for a test. No, I don't want to go for assessment. No, I don't want to go to counseling. But my guess is, as a parent, that's not going to be the first time you've heard your child say no. But as a parent, you have to do what you feel is in the best interest for your child and for your family. And if you believe that the situation has gotten to the point where you need an assessment, then you get the assessment done regardless of what the child says. If the recommendation is treatment, whether it be inpatient or outpatient, of course, the child's not going to agree to do that. But as a parent, you have to insist on it. And I've seen a number of teenagers come into treatment and they come in angry and they come in upset and they come in crying and begging and bargaining to get out of it. And the situation has got, unfortunately, so severe that the parents had no option other than to insist that the child come in for treatment. And yes, they came in angry and upset. But what I noticed was after a week or so, they sort of settled down. They got into the treatment process. They started to work with the professionals. And most of them made remarkable progress. But it's going to be a little rough at the beginning because the child is going to be so oppositional. Mm-hmm. But as the parent, You know, you do what you believe is right and you make the decisions. And if your decision is to get a test, to get an assessment, or to put the child in treatment, then that's what you need to do.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's really good to say to parents, you know, you have permission to act as the adult.
Yeah.
And to, you know, make the appointments and drag them kicking and screaming there, because ultimately it's what's going to save, you know, your child and the whole family, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's a difficult decision. You know, it's a painful decision for parents. But it's also the right decision that ultimately, hopefully, will help your child improve, will help the entire family situation improve. So it's a difficult decision, but, you know, unfortunately, it's a decision that has to be made in all too many cases. Mm-hmm. And that brings up the need that when a family is in that situation, they need support and they need help too. First of all, they're making a very difficult decision, a very painful decision, and this treatment is going to take some time. So it's important that the family get support and that the family get help as well as they go through this journey with their child.
Absolutely. So any final words to the parents and everyone out there listening?
I recommend that you get a copy of the book, The Addicted mm-hmm. Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse. It's only about 100 pages, so it's not going to take a lot of time to read. But I would hope that after reading it, that you feel as a parent that you are more knowledgeable, that you are more equipped, and you feel more confident that if you have to deal with this issue, you hope you don't, but if you do have to deal with this issue, that you feel better prepared and more confident to do so. That's what I'm hoping comes out of somebody reading this book. So my recommendation is get a copy of the book. You can get it on Amazon. You can go to the book's website, helptheaddictedchild.com. And take a little bit of time to read it and maybe keep it on your bookshelf or loan it out to another family that you think might find it helpful.
Mm. Yeah, very true. So thank you so much, Richard. It's been invaluable. Some really good advice out there. Again, like I said, you know, parents need support as well, and they need to know where they can turn to. So that's been really good. And I hope that, you know, everyone grabs themselves a copy of that book and educates themselves.
Thank you, Sherry. It's been a pleasure to be with you. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. And I hope our discussion has been helpful to everyone in your audience that has an opportunity to listen to us. Thank you so much.
I'm sure it has. Thank you, Richard.
I hope you found this episode as helpful and as interesting as I have. Statistics are a powerful instrument to present a problem, and I hope you've come away with a clearer picture of the conversations you need to have with your child on the dangers of substance misuse, hopefully before a problem has manifested itself. You can find out more about Richard's book on his website www.helptheaddictedchild.com. If you're a parent and have found this helpful, drop me a comment, or perhaps you have a story you'd like to share with me on my podcast. If so, then reach out to me on email, shari@sharilewisonfrisch.com. Thank you. Until the next time, take care and goodbye.